final speaker is Dennis Byrne. Dennis's background is in archaeology, but he manages the research section of the Cultural Heritage Division in the Department of Environment and Conservation. For those of us who've worked in the heritage area, Dennis's work has been important in showing ways to challenge the accepted norms of conservation practice. Heritage legislation can have the unfortunate effect of seeking that status that's been talked about a bit here, rather than the flux and movement which are much more difficult to capture in things like listing processes and conservation plans and the like. In particular, Dennis's work with Maria Nugent on mapping attachment gave heritage practitioners new tools in dealing with some of these challenges in bureaucratic environments. Dennis's paper today continues these intellectual inventions and is titled Popular Religion and Nature in Southeast Asia.
I want to start talking about a task force which is located in part of the IUCN. Now, the IUCN, as most of you probably know, is the counterpart of UNESCO in the United Nations, and it's the international Union for the Conservation of Nature. It's actually a much bigger organization than UNESCO. And inside the IUCN is the World Commission on Protected Areas, which is mainly deals with national parks around the world and people who work in national parks. And inside that is the specialist group on cultural and spiritual values of protected areas. And inside that, they have this task force. The task force kind of language is quite symptomatic of the UNESCO and IUCN language. There's almost a kind of a military ring about it. Anyway, galvanizes people to get out there and do things. These images are from the task force's website, which you might like to look at that website. Now, I have been I've been involved in writing a chapter for a volume which the task force is putting together. And it's a volume on what they call natural sacred sites. As you can see, sometimes that term comes out as sacred natural sites. These are essentially areas of natural environment which have seem to have endured and survived because of their religious value to local groups who are living in those environments or around them. Their interest to conservation biologists is lies primarily in the fact that these areas are seen to have conservation values, are seen to have to harbour biodiversity and biodiversity in areas where you wouldn't find biodiversity if these natural sites, most of which in fact are forests, if they haven't been religiously significant. And my chapter for this volume is on Thailand. And what I've tried to do in that chapter is argue that the discourse that has developed among conservation biologists around natural sacred sites simplifies indigenous religion. And in the context of Thailand, it characterizes religion far more in terms of what I would refer to as state Buddhism, rather than folk Buddhism or popular religion in Thailand. The main distinction between those two categories is that on the side of popular religion and folk Buddhism, places, objects, and in this case, the trees and forests, are seen to be animated by supernatural force. So these are not places in nature which are sacred simply because they were created by a creator god. They are sacred in terms of popular religion because the sites themselves, or the trees, or the rocks, are actually inhabited by a spirit or deity that can that has agency. These things are agentic. They can act upon people as much as people act upon them, and that is the nature, really, of the relationship that people have with them locally. And my argument is that the natural sacred site discourse has kind of emerged out of a European Protestant, essentially, vision of nature, which has rationalized nature and rationalized religion. And what it drops out of the picture is the supernatural. Now, okay. So I want to talk a little bit now about leaving forests, to talk a little bit about the built environment in Thailand. So I'm sort of in the area of material culture and cultural heritage, which is, as Jodie mentioned, more my field. And I have had a long-term interest in the way that in terms of popular religion in Thailand, there's been a tendency for government agencies to neglect to record sites that are of significance to local communities, such as spirit shrines, and also, you know, the sacred natural sites. But I've primarily focused on spirit shrines and objects that are seen as being supernaturally empowered, objects that are empowered by monks who pray over them. So that would include statues of the Buddha and amulets, but also includes archaeological sites and ruins in the jungle, statues of kings. All of these objects in the sphere of popular religion are seen to be animated by power, by supernatural power. And in the field of material culture, we would use the Hegelian notion of the dialectic to characterize the kind of interaction and interdependency that exists between objects and people. So, in Daniel Miller's terms, for instance, he would say things make us as much as we make things. Things that we create, obviously we do create them, but once they're out in the world, they start affecting very much the way that we live. We only have to think of, you know, ourselves sitting here in our clothes, in this room, you know, in this university, in the city. We're just completely, not only surrounded by material culture, we're deeply affected by it, and our actions and our thoughts are affected by it. So there's this dialectical relationship we have with material culture, and when that material culture is believed to have spiritual power, that dialectical relationship takes on a particular character. This is a famous Buddhist stupa in southern Thailand. I wanted to show it because it's very much the kind of object that people create and continue to act upon, in the sense that they continue to renew it and rebuild it. It started off as a much smaller object and has grown to be the size that it's seen now. Typically inside stupas like that, there are sacred objects, including amulets like these, which are being sold on the street in Bangkok. People break into the stupas, steal the amulets go into circulation, and the amulets themselves are considered to be miraculously efficacious, and Thais wear them around, or Thai men wear them around their necks as invulnerability charms. There's a man in the newspaper recently who's got a whole string of amulets around his neck, and the reason, well, we don't know the reason that he actually has them, but they certainly are invulnerability charms. And if he was in the red shirt camp in Bangkok, there would have been a lot of danger there, and you would want to have as much invulnerability as you could get. Moving along, I think the important thing here, before I go back to talk a little bit about nature, is that miraculous efficacy is not perceived by people to be a stable quality. It waxes and wanes. And people think in terms of an object or a site, like a, an object like a stupa, as becoming increasingly miraculous or becoming decreasingly miraculous. There's no kind of steady state with these things. People will appeal to an object like a stupa, will make offerings to statues of the Buddha or popular gods, if it was in China, according to the reputation of those objects. Their reputation for being able to affect cures of illness, get people through university examinations, that kind of thing. So people are attentive to the performance of objects. People won't make offerings to sites or objects which don't perform, or which are seen to no longer be performing. It's obviously an interresponsive aspect of this performativity. If an object or site appears to be unable to perform miracles, people will stop not only making offerings to it, but stop maintaining the site, the building, the temple, the stupa, or whatever. It will start to fall into ruin. Its ruinous state will actually be perceived to actually reflect its declining efficaciousness. There's an obvious circularity in that, which means that signs of decay lead to further withdrawal of support, which leads to further decay, and a place enters on the slippery slope of deterioration, decay, abandonment, ruin. So sacred sites can and do lose their constituency. Going back to the forest then, I have wondered from time to time about how, if forests in Thailand are populated by spirits and deities, both the actual sites of the forests and individual trees very often. How did it come about that so many of the forests in Thailand were cut down by local people? I'm not for the moment thinking about the forests and the highlands around in the Thai border areas. I'm thinking more of the forests that were cut down from about the mid-19th century as agriculture expanded. So I'm talking about local people chopping down forests in order to expand their fields. But those local people would definitely have considered that there were sacred sites in the forests. So, you know, I don't actually have research to base this on. This is speculative, but I'm assuming that there would have been some anxiety about possibility of retribution by forest spirits, which could result in crop failure or illness among people and livestock. But I think we have to consider that, as against that, there's the fact that ritually that kind of retribution can be deflected or resisted using, for instance, things like amulets as invulnerability charms. And we know, for instance, that many archaeological sites in Thailand are dug up, religious archaeological sites, like old sites of old temples, which are on sacralized ground, are dug up by people to rob them of their archaeological objects. Now, there's no question that those people are not risking retribution by the guardian spirits of those sites, but they wear invulnerability charms and they make offerings to the guardian spirits of the sites. So they try to deflect and compensate for what they're actually doing. And spirits themselves are adaptable and receptive to change. There's plenty of ethnography that points to people moving spirit shrines out of forests into cultivated areas. So spirits themselves are adaptable. Since I'm kind of running out of time here a little bit, I'll skip on a bit because I want to say firstly that what I guess I'm saying is that the natural sacred site discourse that we see in the IUCN, what it produces is a kind of sacredness minus the supernatural. And what it also produces is a kind of sacred, which is minus the state. It's minus state politics. And the result of that is that I think this discourse has jumped into bed with unconsciously with some interesting bedfellows, and the major one would be the modern Thai state, which from the mid-19th century has run an anti-superstition campaign against popular religion, against spirit cults, against precisely that kind of supernatural quality which is so prevalent in popular religion, but which is ignored by conservation biologists. So in a sense, they are aligning themselves with the Thai state and state Buddhism. And state Buddhism is also that version of Buddhism that the Thai state propagated from the mid-19th century and which is supposedly canonical, more canonical, and de-emphasizes miracles and the supernatural. Okay, it also plays into that whole aspect of modernity where the spatial element of which the state and the state's spatial programs have been often referred to as leveling, a leveling or flattening of the landscape. What happens is at one level you see railroads and roads built out from capitals like Bangkok across the countryside, and semi-independent communities and principalities are suppressed, and bureaucratic offices are set up in country areas which are controlled by the centre. So that the power of the central government is able to be projected out evenly across the whole state. This is the kind of thing Benjamin Anderson wrote about in his book, Imagine Communities. One of the things that actually gets in the way of that kind of program of levelling is forests, I would argue. They are an actual obstruction to the projection of state power. So that's another aspect, I think, of the of some of the negative things that the this discourse has brought into. So I'll leave it there.